This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. I don't think we need to keep repeating that this show has come to an end, but I do think we should bring forward some of the folks behind the scenes who've helped keep this program running. Our producers, Drew Dodlin and Micah Gayson, and our engineer, Adam Gross. This is our last full show. Next week, we're going to be playing Best of Episodes. So this is it in a way. Drew, I'm going to start with you. How did your journey lead you to All In? Since my understanding is you were part of the original programming when it first launched.
Yeah. So I was part of the original team. Adam was there too. So the original team, Matt Pelzer was the host, if people remember, and then Maggie Galon was the other producer back then. I was a reporter in the local newsroom for a while and then moved over to the show. And yeah, it was late 2019. No Limits had ended, which was a talk show here. And so it was sort of a replacement for that. But that's how I ended up here.
Micah, same question for you. How did you get involved with All In?
Yeah, so I started as a news reporting intern in the newsroom back in 2019. And then, yeah, so Maggie, the original other producer, she left. And so they kind of needed someone to fill in. And I was in school at the time. So I was like, yeah, I'll do it while I'm doing this and doing school. So after that, after I graduated, I joined the team full time.
Adam, what was your start with the show like? I know Drew mentioned you were also one of the originals. How was it when you started versus like the pandemic and how things changed?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I need a whole hour. yeah, when I started, I was a noob. I hadn't done radio really before. My engineering background's in music. So I learned it all with the show, which was really nice. But when I started, we were all here. Drew was here, Matt was here, Maggie was here, and we would chat before the show, chat after the show. It was very communal. When the pandemic hit, no one was here. It was just me and the custodian for over a year. I had to be here to send the show out. So it was kind of terrifying sometimes to be alone. But I was stuck through it. I was glad that I was able to help get the show out to people. But yeah, everything went remote and things changed. All our guests went to Google and instead of coming in. So it has been quite the journey.
Yeah. And one thing I want to mention is I don't know if we've all actually met in person. I've met Micah, but mm-hmm. I haven't met you, Adam, or Drew. And I don't know, Micah, have you met any of them in person?
Yeah, I've met Drew. Me and Drew actually worked together while I was an intern, but I don't think I've met Adam before.
Micah, we met once really briefly when we were both helping pickup recording for, what was it?
It was for This American Life.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. So this was already when the pandemic had already started. And I came in to do like a tape sync for This American Life. And I think, yeah, you're right. We met kind of like in passing. And right. That was the first and last time that I saw you.
Yeah.
Wow. Time definitely flies, right? Like, it's just like, was that 2 years ago? Was that a year ago? Drew, are there any favorite shows or segments that we've done on the show or that you've produced that you really enjoyed?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably a boring answer, but I feel really good about the pandemic coverage we did just because the pandemic has obviously taken over everything for years now. And it just always felt really good to give a lot of time to conversations about that, especially with epidemiologists and people that, you know, most of us are hearing maybe 20-second little clips from and little news stories. And to me, it was just like really refreshing to have and provide like a full hour of conversation about something, which maybe I'm overestimating people's desire to hear a full hour about the pandemic during the pandemic. I'm sure at times it was a little exhausting, but I don't know. That stuff is really important, I think, to dig into and just give time to, for probably obvious reasons.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left. Micah, do you have any favorite moments from the program?
I definitely do have a lot of favorite moments, actually. But I will say, instead of kind of going to one show or one segment in particular, I think honestly, like we brought a lot of like great conversations to our listeners. And so like they didn't really hear much of like the conversations the producers had with the guests before we even had our live show. There were some times when, you know, our usual conversations with the guests that we have before the show, they're supposed to be, you know, like 20 minutes or so. But there are times when I would sit and talk with a guest for like an hour just because like they had so much to say and I was like, you know, learning a lot from them. It's really those moments that I really enjoyed, like, you know, the kind of work that we bring with All In. So,
and Adam, I'm going to give you like 30 seconds here. Okay. I'm going to be generous. You created the music for this show. So it would be remiss not to mention that. What are you hoping to do with the musical stuff moving forward?
Yeah, I'm in talks with some people here about working on some music for some programs or things with WFYI. And I play music a lot with various bands around Indianapolis. So I'm doing that. But it is really weird to hear a piece of music you wrote two times a day, every day for almost 3 years. I've never experienced that before. I'm kind of going to miss it, but I'm also kind of glad I don't have to hear it every day.
You could use it as your alarm clock in the morning.
It's true.
Well, I want to thank all of you, Drew, Micah, and Adam, for sharing your stories. And a thank you to our managing editor, Scott Cameron, who encouraged us to think outside the box. And now it's time to switch gears and get some information on what's been going on in Indiana and what we can expect in the near future. With us to discuss her reporting these last few years is Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Jeannie Lindsay. Jeannie, what have been some of the bigger stories you've worked on, let's say, this past year?
Yeah, so obviously top of mind. We just came out of the legislative session and there was a lot going on with that. But before session, I worked on a story about rural childcare access, which I think is pretty important, especially given how childcare has kind of evolved and changed over the course of COVID-19. I've also been, obviously last fall, I was doing a lot of tracking of COVID data and guidance, the guidance from the health department and schools and what effect it was having on schools and students, student learning. So COVID very much has still been a huge part of what I've been reporting and what has been essential to talk about, because it's had so many different ripple effects in so many different places, pretty much all places of education. And to that end, I mean, I last summer did a story about an effort of school support staff in Kokomo to unionize. Earlier in the year, I was talking about the experiences. It was this time last year talking about what it's been like to be a teacher for a year of COVID, and now we're at a second year. And so talking about those experiences and what that's been like, some of the support and creative ways that people are trying to approach those issues, certainly.
Well, what helps you to keep pushing forward in a field that can sometimes feel isolating, especially with the pandemic? You know, what has your personal experience been like?
Yeah, it certainly hasn't been easy. I don't think anybody has really had it easy that's doing this work, especially. But the things that drive me forward, I mean, first of all, I think about why I got into journalism in the first place. You know, connecting people to one another, listening to stories, hearing people's stories, and sharing those to combat isolation even before COVID. And that's just been especially critical during COVID with all of the isolation that we've had. I think that motivator of, you know, hearing stories that compel me personally, or learning things that I had never known about, you know, I want to share that as much as possible. So connecting people to one another, even when feeling isolated, I think has been a really good driving force for me. I also think from just a news you can use standpoint, I mean, especially when there are constantly churning things and regulations and questions and effects of something as huge and devastating as a pandemic, I think it's even more critical for journalists and for myself to continue getting people information that helps them, equips them with the best tools to make decisions about what they want their lives to look like. And I'd also be remiss, quite honestly, not to mention the team of people that have been doing this work alongside me. I mean, I think motivations on the personal side certainly have driven me forward, but man, I could not have lasted this long without just an amazing team of people at the state level, but also all the stations that we work with across Indiana. I mean, it really has been incredible to see how my colleagues and you know, partners in this work, other journalists have really rallied to keep doing what needs to be done for our communities. And that's also inspired me just to see the work that my team has done, the support they've offered, and all of it really has kept me going even on the hardest days.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, are there any topics or issues you're already looking ahead to that we can look forward to learning more about?
Yeah, I think teacher workforce stuff, early childhood education workforce stuff is really important. Also, the culture and climate of schools as it relates to the academic effects. I think that academic impact and programs to focus on academics are one thing, but the culture of schools is also another huge part of it. And we've seen conversations about that legislatively and you know, in the state house, out of the state house. I think that's going to be a really critical piece to look at, and something I'm certainly interested in looking at looking forward.
What do you hope audiences will take away from the stories you share?
Yeah, kind of like what I was saying about what motivates me. I mean, I hope they find some connection, whether it's, you know, learning something new or seeing themselves reflected in a story in some way. I think that it's really important. One of the things that I want people to get from my reporting is, you know, knowing more about their world, their communities, and the experiences that are shared or new to them. But I think what I really want from my reporting, I want people to have some connection to it in some way, that they feel compelled to do something or to talk with other people to do something. Or, you know, change things. So I think that I just want people to feel connected, but also equipped with more information about how things are going and what's happening in their world.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jeannie. It's been a pleasure to have you on the program as one of our regular contributors. And good luck with everything. And we'll keep in touch and keep an eye out for your reporting.
Absolutely. And you as well, Miriam. It's been a pleasure working with you and coming on the show. I'm sad it's over, but I'm so grateful for all the opportunities.
Thank you so much. Indiana Public Broadcasting education reporter Jeannie Lindsay. Coming up, we'll hear from environment and energy reporter Rebecca Thiel, and we'll check in with our political reporter Brandon Smith. Lots of things have happened over the last year in state government, and many issues have brought national attention to our state. We'll find out more after the break. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're focusing our final show on the wonderful reporters from Indiana Public Broadcasting who've routinely kept us up to date with the latest happenings across the state. We're going to speak now with Rebecca Thiel, environment and energy reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Rebecca, there have been so many environmental and energy issues these last few years, and while things slowed down during lockdown and the pandemic, I'm curious if some of these issues were brought more to the forefront.
Definitely. Lockdown was an eye-opener. A lot of manufacturing and other businesses were closed, so we needed less energy. So coal plants ran less for fewer hours, and we relied more on renewable sources, which meant less pollution. People were also driving their personal cars less. I think that was pretty well publicized, which also cut down pollution. So I think that told us a lot. It showed us what we can achieve if we had cleaner buildings, cleaner cars. You know, I think it also made us question, what is it that we really need? And how does that fit into having a healthy environment? You know, do we need to have everyone to go to work in person? Do we need coal and natural gas plants for reliable energy? It also, unfortunately, exposed a lot of the problems that folks faced with utility shutoffs. A lot of Hoosiers lost their jobs, and so they experienced not having electricity for the first time, not being able to have cold food, or maybe, you know, they didn't pay their water bill, so they were unable to flush their toilets. You know, these very basic things that we need for our lives. So that really exposed the holes in payment plans and other things that utilities do when you can't pay your bill. And also that these nonprofits that provide utility assistance are very underfunded.
What would you say have been some of the biggest stories to come out of Indiana in the environment sector?
So it's hard for me to decouple energy and environment, but one of them I would say is lead pipes. Since the Flint water crisis happened, it's still going on. About 8 years ago, we kind of were slowly finding out this is not just a Flint problem. This is a cross-country problem. And, you know, it's not also just an urban problem. You know, we're finding out more that rural areas also have this issue of lead pipes and drinking water. That, again, it makes it hard for kids to learn and be successful in their careers later on if they have lead poisoning. It can also cause behavioral problems that are really hard to diagnose. And while we've seen some money from the federal government in the past to help replace lead pipes, and some utilities have done some of that work, we really haven't been tackling it until just a few years ago. I think when the Indianapolis NAACP found out just how much lead there is in the drinking water in Marion County schools, that really mobilized public health advocates in the state. IUPUI is offering free anonymous lead testing kits. Lawmakers like Democratic Representative Carolyn Jackson have been consistently putting forth bills to tackle this problem. And this year, we saw a bill from Republican Representative Brad Barrett that would screen every child under 6 for lead at their doctor's office. That's huge. We haven't really been the best as a country and as a state in figuring out which children have lead poisoning and trying to address their issues. Now, I should say the governor hasn't signed that bill into law yet, but it is looking like it has a lot of support. Obviously, that's the first step, just finding out which kids have lead poisoning. But I think that it's going to be the start of something that we're going to see to address this problem.
Rebecca, what would you say have been some of the biggest stories to come out of this state in the energy sector?
I would say coal plant closures, the response to these big renewable energy projects, and cities' response to climate change has really been the big one. You know, we're going to see at least 7 coal plants close in the state by the end of this decade. That's not only a huge shift in energy, but of course, what happens to those jobs? What happens to the jobs that are connected to those coal plants, like mining? And what's going to happen to these small towns where the coal plants make up so much of the tax base? Just in the past year or so, state lawmakers have finally started to realize that they can't really prevent utilities from closing these coal plants. So we need to start thinking about how do we create these new economies in these communities. And I think that that's going to be a really interesting conversation moving forward. You know, that response to these big renewable energy projects partially replacing that energy from those coal plants. You know, Indiana utilities have plans to build a lot of renewable energy in the coming years, such as the Mammoth Solar Project. I believe that's 1 gigawatt of solar. That's a huge amount. But, you know, some counties have laws that are wind and solar friendly and some don't. And we've seen projects fail because of that. I think the majority of these projects that are being proposed are in rural areas, and it seems like that's really divided the residents there. You know, you might have a farmer who would love to see a solar farm on their land to try to make enough money to keep that farm, but they might have a neighbor who specifically came out into the country to avoid living next to things that they feel are industrial. So, you know, that's been a really big conversation here in Indiana. And then cities working to adapt to climate change and make these greenhouse gas reduction plans with the help of Indiana University's Environmental Resilience Institute. You know, at least 40 cities in the state have started looking at their greenhouse gas emissions. That's a big chunk of the population. Fort Wayne, Gary, Bloomington. Granted, these are all just goals at this point. We'll have to see if they can achieve them. And some cities have already said that because of what their utilities are doing, such as Duke Energy, that's making it harder for cities to do that by not moving away from fossil fuels fast enough. Many state lawmakers have also not made it easy for cities to achieve some of those goals, too. There was a bill, I think it was, I can't remember if it was last year or the year before, that banned the banning of natural gas in new homes, for example. So all of these things, we're seeing a lot of tension in this transition to renewable energy and a lot of tension in trying to figure out how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions while also being open to business, which is something that Indiana has always felt is important.
Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, what has your experience been like covering these issues at a time when there's so much information being pushed out to audiences that it can often be hard to differentiate between news and misinformation?
It's so strange because I speak with people and sometimes they say, I don't think what you told me is right because I heard this. And, you know, whatever they're talking about, I might not even know where that's coming from. And that's pretty scary because how can you combat misinformation if you don't know where it's coming from? It's not their fault. Companies that stand to lose from things like reducing carbon emissions are working really hard to make it confusing and make it seem like an article or a video that's made by a professional journalist. But they have a clear agenda. And if they have an agenda, a lot of people assume I have one, right? I actually had somebody ask me that, what's your agenda? And other than informing people about the issues related to energy and the environment in our state, I don't really have one. And I think because of the media environment that we're in now, it's really hard for people to understand that. And I think it makes it hard for people to trust what we do. So I would really encourage folks who, whatever you consume, whether that's an article or a video or a blog, find out who's writing it. Who do they work for? Who funds them? Look at the about page on a website where you're reading an article. If you're not sure that a person is a journalist, think about not sharing that on social media and especially being extra critical of what you already believe. If you find an article that you think really aligns with your beliefs, be extra careful and know what you're sharing.
Very good points and tips. And thank you so much for the reporting that you've been doing and that we've been able to talk about on this program. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate all in is done. And thank you so much.
Rebecca Thiel, Environment and Energy Reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Now it's time to check in with Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He always has great insight into what's going on, why, and who the key players are. Brandon, thank you for joining us on this final show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always been a pleasure to be on.
What would you say have been the biggest news stories to come out of the State House these last 2 years with COVID?
Well, obviously the state's response to the pandemic is first and foremost the biggest thing that's come out of the Indiana State House the last 2 years. The way I'll answer this question is I'll say, I think the biggest story has been how the General Assembly has responded to what the state has done, both at the state level and at the local level. And so what I mean by that is that, Governor Eric Holcomb took a lot of big steps, particularly early on in the pandemic, and lawmakers, conservative Republican lawmakers, I should say, were very upset at that. There's a lot of COVID denialism in the General Assembly. Broader than that, there's COVID misinformation about the virus and the vaccine. And so what you've seen out of the legislature then is efforts to sort of restrict what the governor can do in a future emergency, a future health emergency. In fact, there's still a lawsuit going on that's gonna be heard by the Indiana Supreme Court soon over whether or not lawmakers can call themselves into a special session of the legislature during a statewide public emergency like we had during COVID-19. We'll see what the outcome of that is, but it's emblematic of this fight over emergency powers and executive powers over the last 2 years. And like I said, that doesn't just extend to the state level, it also extends to the local level. What we've seen over the last two sessions around COVID-19 has been the legislature dismantling expertise at the local level, taking power out of the hands of local health officials and putting it in the hands of local elected officials, some of whom don't want that power, quite frankly. Nevertheless, that's what's been done, restricting the ability of local health officials to respond more quickly to emergencies without getting authorization and votes and so on from local elected officials. Now, what lawmakers say is they're trying to make the people making decisions more responsive to the voters, because local health officials aren't elected by voters. They're appointed by local elected officials. But again, as I said, the argument on the other side is that, you know, your local city council person, your local county councilor, isn't necessarily, and in most cases is not, a public health expert. The people that they appoint to be public health experts are public health experts, and so they should be making the decisions. So that's, I think, to me, the biggest story out of the last 2 years.
Well, on that note, do you think Indiana did well as a state when it came to making sure the pandemic was under control and folks got enough information, or was there just too much misinformation going around?
I'll say from the state level, from the governor's office, and you know, the pandemic in Indiana began just after the legislature adjourned in 2020. So you had about 9 months where the governor was the only game in town when it came to the government response at the state level to COVID-19. And I'd say early on, Indiana did exceptionally well. The governor issued the stay-at-home order, which was damaging to businesses and the economy, but we saw that in a lot of places. And what it did do was it helped, at least in the short term, sort of put a lid on it. And then things slowly started to open up as Governor Holcomb got more and more pressure from Republicans to lift a lot of these restrictions. But Governor Holcomb consistently, for most of the last 2 years, has been pushing the best public health measures, at least when he talked about it. He's been pushing, you know, he pushed wearing masks. He has pushed getting vaccines more than just about any Republican you're likely to see, and has been unwavering in that, despite increased outrage from many in his party about the safety and efficacy of these vaccines, which are both safe and effective at preventing significant consequences from COVID-19. So I'd say early on, Indiana did great. That has, over time, become undone a little bit. And part of it is the one area, if you had to pick, that Indiana has done the poorest is getting the vaccine itself.
Well, we have just a few minutes left here, and I want to make sure we talk about the legislative session that wrapped up recently. Were there any clear winners or losers on various issues?
I'd say both. House Republicans got a huge tax cut that they'd been pushing for a long time. Not everything that they wanted, but they got a lot of what they wanted. Senate Republicans, though, held the line and refused to cut a business tax that they were really concerned about affecting local governments. And so they held the line on that, and that didn't go through. The transgender community got a victory recently when the governor vetoed a bill that would have banned transgender girls from playing high school sports, although that veto is likely to be overturned. And then the law enforcement community, I think, are clear losers in that they almost universally opposed a bill to allow anyone to carry a handgun in public without a permit. And that bill was signed into law by the governor. And so that was against the clear wishes of law enforcement.
So to clarify on the gun bills, so now anyone can walk around with a gun and they don't need to have a permit.
That's correct. And I shouldn't say anyone. There are still, if you weren't allowed to carry a gun with a permit right now, then you won't be allowed to carry a gun without a permit. The problem, of course, is how will you know you're not allowed to carry a gun if you don't have to go through a permit process in order to do so?
Where does our state stand with what's been happening with Russia and Ukraine right now? Have you heard anything from state government officials?
It's limited action so far. Governor Holcomb was exploring whether or not we have economic ties to Russia in state investments and state contracts, but there hasn't been any action to sever those ties if they're there. He has indicated a complete willingness, as he has on with other refugees in the past, that if there are any Ukrainian refugees that come to the United States, Indiana is open to receiving them.
And one final thing before we let you go, I think the pandemic forced a lot of folks to rethink their trajectory. Did you see any of that in state government in terms of the kinds of laws being passed or proposed? I mean, I think, you know, some of it was like these emergency powers became a contentious issue, but anything else?
Yeah, I would think that's the biggest one. It's rethinking what the role of government should be in a public health emergency or a public emergency of any kind. And unfortunately, I think you could view a lot of what the General Assembly has done as being more challenging in future emergencies.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure, Brandon, to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up, the pandemic is in a holding pattern of sorts, but it's created plenty of news for Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. We'll hear from her as well as workforce reporter Justin Hicks on the latest. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Following the latest news and trends in news and the digital space is one thing you can find Lauren Chapman, digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, doing. But what you may recognize from Lauren's work is the focus on COVID-19. We're going to hear more about these stories and what else Lauren's been focused on. She joins us now. Welcome to the program, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
What have the past 2 years been like with the work that you do? Did you pivot from what you thought you were doing to becoming a resident expert in COVID data?
I mean, I think anybody who's an expert in COVID data has had to do that pivot. On the team, the running joke is that I am the protest reporter, where I was more of a, from a reporting standpoint, I was more of a backup for folks when they would like go on vacations or be out for any extended period of time, because I was already copy editing all of their stories. So it was one of those things where it made a lot of sense for me to be that backup. And with COVID, our health reporter left for a different job right before the pandemic hit. And so we had a contract reporter who then also left the collaboration for a full-time job. Darian Benson is doing incredible work for Side Effects. So I ended up being the person who had the most love and appreciation for spreadsheets and data. And that's how I ended up being the COVID reporter, which was a nice place to put all of my COVID anxiety into. That's where I've been ever since.
So you said a love for numbers and spreadsheets and stuff like that. Did you have to wade through a lot of data to find the story?
Oh yeah, no. Like I have a bachelor's of the arts degree, because I wasn't a particularly science or math focused person. I'm going to be real with you, my AP statistics teacher from high school will occasionally find me on Facebook and razz me about the fact that, like, I'm doing statistical analyses of COVID data as a part of my job. And especially since my final project for his class was measuring the number of people who were asleep in it my senior year of high school. So Mr. McKenna, wherever you are, I'm still doing the good work. Thanks for your patience. But yeah, it is something that I've really appreciated and really grown into. And I'm really grateful specifically to all of the epidemiologists and just general COVID nerds who over the last 2 years have really, you know, taken the time and space to help me learn as it was necessary to report.
How has the pandemic changed the way you do your work, or has it had any change?
Yeah, see, the collaboration, IPB News, we're all based at different stations across the state. So like the day-to-day work of you know, interacting with my teammates, interacting with reporters across the state, like that hasn't really changed. We've been doing this since 2016. But the work itself is very different. There's a lot more mean people on Twitter. There's certainly a lot more changes in, you know, being a little bit more intentional about what is in my my go bag for covering events and things like that. And certainly the difference of not being in a newsroom. I started working from home. I was the last person to leave the office. I started working from home in July of 2021 after moving into a slightly larger apartment. So that's been a pretty significant change of how that has all changed for me. But yeah, otherwise pretty similar.
Yeah, I would say with the remote work, it's been interesting. I haven't met anyone aside from Micah in person, and it still feels like we kind of know each other using the tech that we do. Do you see this playing out in any way as the future of media work? Are we going to see more of a grasp to use these tools in public media?
I certainly hope so. One of the things, so we do reporting for radio and TV stations, and so it makes it really convenient to put together a Google Meet or a Zoom call in order to set up a remote video setup for folks across the country. Everyone's getting a little bit more used to how to set up their web cameras so that they're properly framed. And so that makes it so, so much easier. But I think it also makes some of the community engagement stuff that we do, the events, the listening sessions, it also makes it more important to be there in person. That, like, as you know, we have these ebbs and flows in COVID cases, that when we are in a valley where we have like real safety, that we can gather in person, that it makes those conversations a little bit higher stakes and so much better than I think it did before the panini.
Well, how has or what have been some of the biggest stories when you look back that you've been working on?
Yeah, I'm really proud. We gathered up everything for Journalism Awards season, and I'm really, really proud of the sad math stories that I did. I think that it's really easy to get lost in the numbers and kind of become desensitized to it. And to a certain extent, I'm really proud of the work that I did with that. But I also got to report two features last year, one about a anti-protest bill following the protests in June 2020 that especially Indianapolis saw, Fort Wayne saw, cities across the state and country saw. I'm really, really proud of the work that I did with that. I'm really proud of the story that I did, or the feature I did most recently about religious vaccine exemptions and really digging into what federal vaccine exemptions, for especially, religious vaccine exemptions do, why they exist, the history and context. Like, those are kind of the things that I'm most proud of, to say nothing of all of the work that, everybody else on the team has done.
Yeah, the stuff you've done has been really fascinating, and we've always appreciated having you come on and explain it for us in more detail. Before we get ready to wrap up, is there anything you're looking towards for the future, anything you're working on now?
Yeah, there's all sorts of stuff. I'm sure I'll remember one of them. of course, we're barreling, you know, we're heading toward another midterm election. So we'll have the primaries in May, we'll have the election in November. There's a lot of really cool in-depth reporting that Rebecca Thiel is doing on climate and climate solutions. And so there's a lot of really cool projects that are coming down the pipeline that I'm really excited about in the near term, and then in the longer term, being able to get out into the community a little bit more before whatever next wave of COVID looks like, is something I'm really looking forward to.
And I was going to actually ask you about that, because it seems like it's inevitable this is going to keep going up and down. Do you think you're going to continue to be the resident COVID reporter?
Yeah, you know, it's more of a habit than anything else. So anytime I see my parents and grandparents, I'm usually raging about COVID data. Anytime I'm around my friends, I'm like, hey, actually, you should stay home this weekend because, you know, the COVID data. Or actually, no, it's safe to go on your little IKEA adventure because the COVID data is down. So I think at this point, 2 years of a habit is good enough for it to stick.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Lauren. It's a pleasure to have you on, and we'll keep in touch.
Thank you so much.
Lauren Chapman is digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting. As we get ready to wrap up our final show, we have one more guest who we've had the pleasure to speak with and get updates on everything workforce related. With us now is Justin Hicks, workforce reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Justin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You've been covering a ton of stuff, and I almost don't even know where to begin, but I have to ask the same thing I've been asking everyone. Did the pandemic affect your reporting?
100%. We did not expect the pandemic at all. And in fact, I have this very vivid memory of, I had a story that I was wrapping up, and I, you know, worked on it for a little while, for a few weeks, right before the pandemic happened, about cybersecurity. And I just remember in March 2020, wrapping up the story, you know, we had everything we needed, we had all the photos, everything was set. And then the pandemic struck. And we were like, oh, my God, like, we can't really click publish on this. This has nothing to do with the pandemic. And everybody wants to just know about the pandemic right now. So it's been frozen for a little while. We're trying to find a way to revive it, actually.
Mm-hmm. And did it give you more content or less? Like, did you feel like everything was more focused on how it tied to the pandemic?
Yeah. I mean, way more content. Than we expected, I think, simply because people, I mean, we were all right, like, confused and scared, and everyone needed good information. But of course, we remember, like, remember how the information just kept changing over and over and over again. So, you know, for me, it was a lot of unemployment insurance information. You know, people were being laid off of work in droves. I mean, you know, just huge amounts of people being laid off. And people needed to know, how do we access these services? So, yeah, I mean, tons of content.
Well, I do want to talk about that a little bit. Since the pandemic hit so many people in different ways, one of those was that folks were losing jobs or having to leave jobs because they didn't feel they were protected enough from COVID. And as you mentioned, you reported on unemployment insurance. How did that fit into things? And then what about unemployment in general?
Yeah. So I remember in the early days of the pandemic, there was we had kind of a twofold reporting approach. One was, we just wanted to hear stories from people about, you know, this kind of humanizing element that journalism does really well of, you know, here are people who, for circumstances completely out of their control, they were laid off of work and they don't know when they're going to come back. And that's really scary. And these are the, you know, this is exactly what unemployment insurance is built for. But I'm sure you also remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there was that narrative of sort of like, you know, well, if you're not working, you're lazy, right? Mm-hmm. We were trying to report on this to show that, listen, like, these people are not lazy. These are people that really want to work and really want to earn a living, but it just, the rug got pulled out from underneath them. So we had these kind of humanizing stories on one hand. On the other hand, we had these explainer stories that we did a lot of to kind of show people, okay, there's a lot of really, you know, minute terms, really in the weeds terms here when you apply for unemployment insurance. Let's break down what those terms mean so that you can understand what the heck you're being asked when you're asking for government assistance here. So that was a lot of kind of the beginning days. And then as the pandemic went on and on and on, and unemployment insurance, you know, kept becoming an issue, you know, that launched into stories about accountability. You know, it was the Department of Workforce Development paying people in a timely fashion. Were people being overpaid? And if they were being overpaid, what was DWD doing to try to get that money back? How much fraud was going on? You know, there was a lot of claims of these foreign emissaries hacking into the system. And so that became another facet of unemployment. And then another facet, which was also fascinating, was this kind of legal battle that erupted in Indiana, where as the state tried to end these federal expanded benefits early, you know, a state court basically stepped in and said, you can't do that, you know, because of the way Indiana's legal code is written, you must provide all available unemployment insurance benefits that come from the federal government. So, I mean, it was a story and an issue that just kept dragging on and on and on, and was very, very important to a lot of people.
Yeah, I remember at that time when they were trying to stop the funding. I think the narrative was like, because nobody's working, like, we have all these jobs that need employees, so maybe if we stop this funding, they'll go to work.
Yeah, exactly. That was kind of the narrative, and of course, that was really kind of not proven. I mean, there was not a lot of data to show that, and I can understand why people logically think that was what might happen. But again, there was really, like, all economists, a bunch of researchers were all saying, we don't know that for a fact. We don't, you know, we still think that people inherently want to work and want to have that self-worth and dignity of having a job. They're not just, you know, sitting on their couches watching daytime television, which again, I mean, that's a political narrative. And that was something that I think I explored a lot of and learned a lot about myself, was sort of these political narratives, right? Like, how do we tell stories to push a certain agenda? I think that became a really big thread that I think has opened my eyes.
As we look ahead, do you think things seem to be on a trajectory to recovery? And if so, are there any areas you're keeping your eyes on?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm still watching unemployment rates, but of course now we're in a totally different world and a very different scenario where, in fact, our employment rates in Indiana are insanely low. I mean, typically like 3% unemployment is like normal. I mean, that's good, right? That's like full employment. That means most people have jobs. We are now in this range where in a lot of areas, unemployment rates are like 1%, which is like I'm saying, it's bizarre. It's crazy. So we're now in this place where employers actually are in this position where they are begging people to please come and fill jobs. And workers have a lot of options right now. And so they have a lot of power and they can ask for, you know, better sign-on bonuses, or they can ask for education, or they can ask for, you know, raises. So we're in this kind of totally different scenario than we were in the middle of the pandemic, where, you know, there was a lot of people who wanted to work but couldn't find jobs. Now we're in the situation where there's more jobs than ever for people. There's really just not enough workers to fill all those jobs.
Do you think more businesses are adopting a live with it mentality regarding COVID? As we move towards the future?
Yeah, I think kind of. I was talking to someone just yesterday about this. I personally have not seen, you know, COVID really change our workforce habits that much. I think the biggest way it's probably changed things is that more people are now able to work from home if you can. But, you know, Indiana is a very manufacturing heavy state. You can't really manufacture from home. It's not a thing.
Yet. Yet.
Right. So I still think a lot of employers are kind of going back to the old normal. You know, we talked a lot about the new normal. And I think at this point we're just really going back to the old normal. I think we experimented with a lot of changes, and then a lot of the good things that came with those good changes maybe got thrown out the window a little bit.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Justin, for joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the program, you know, for the time that I've been here. And we look forward to seeing what you're up to and keeping in touch with the work.
Of course. Yeah. And I'm, you know, really sad to see you guys go, but wish you best of luck in all your future endeavors.
Thank you so much. Justin Hicks, workforce reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you to all our guests today and to you, our wonderful audience. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yasin. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.